Welcome to the Maintainable Software Podcast, where we explore the art of improving existing software with seasoned practitioners who have helped organizations overcome the problems often associated with technical debt and legacy code. I'm your host, Robbie Russell. On this episode, Kyle Daigle, who is a seasoned engineer, speaker, and is currently the Chief Operating Officer at GitHub. Kyle joins us from his home in the state of Connecticut, the Boston side. He said that might come across as cheeky, but I'm on the West Coast, so I don't really understand. Please explain. Kyle Daigle, we're so glad to have you join us on Maintainable. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to finally be here with you.
I've been looking forward to this ever since we talked about it in Amsterdam. So thank you for joining. So as you reflect on your experience in the industry, what do you believe are a few common characteristics of, dare I say, well-maintained software?
Yeah, you know, I think it's funny. I, you know, started my career as a developer. I guess it wasn't a career at that point. I was 13, right? And my real thing that I thought was important was that it just worked, that it like solved the problem. And I didn't really care that much about testing or anything like that. I think over time, I kind of oscillated from, I think software, you know, should be interesting and should be novel and well-crafted, et cetera. And I think now I think the most well-maintainable software ends up being straightforward and it's easy to read. Like, we're humans processing this. And so I really don't like anything that tends to be overly dry. Like, I think verbosity is not the worst thing in the world, ultimately, you know, particularly in a day and age now where relying on other tools to help us write software more and more. And so when I joined GitHub in 2013, I got dropped into some code bases that all had some really quaint and interesting names that were fun, you know, back then. But like, coming up to speed, half of it is like, well, what does this variable even mean? Like, this is a, oh, this is an internal term we use for this other thing, versus, oh, this variable is an array of integers that count age or like whatever, you know what I mean? And so I think for me, it's like simplicity and verbosity end up being something that I keep looking back to in code that I wrote a long time ago, or when I jump into a code base, being clever or overly dry or like extremely well encapsulated, I think helps to some degree when you scale a system. But I feel like 9 times out of 10, if you looked at a code base at GitHub or Shopify or Intercom or any of these companies that have been around for quite some time or in Ruby, you also realize that like when the rubber hits the road, it's well thought through and well crafted, but usually that's well architected and not necessarily like perfect software that is written down in the code base. It's usually a little bit more messy when the rubber actually hits the road.
Do you think there's any, you know, I think I was thinking about the naming, you know, as you were talking there about like clever names and stuff like that, you know, knowing what little I know about the people that were around when GitHub started and kind of the energy and the vibe of the Ruby and the Rails community at that point in time, and we were both around then. And do you feel like that in some ways that was kind of like also part of the secret sauce to be goofy and creative in certain ways? And how do you kind of weigh that up? I think of like, was that part of the success? But then also was like, well, we have to clean this up because it's kind of complicated too.
Yeah, it's like, it's interesting because I think, you know, when we were kind of talking and preparing for the podcast and we were just talking about maintainable software, that doesn't necessarily mean joyful software, you know, or like fun and exciting software. And so, yeah, I mean, like, you know, the service that I really kind of cut my teeth on at GitHub was this service called Hookshot, which was our webhook service. And Rick Olson, you know, Technoweenie, you know, named that and created that. And we got to work together for quite some time at GitHub. And it's a really cute, fun, interesting name. It, like, energetic and exciting. And then you go, okay, well, if it's Hookshot, then what other sort of Zelda-y memes can I pull into this to name other things? And I think that's joyful, you know, and it's exciting and it's happy and you kind of build camaraderie with folks. I don't know that it makes it maintainable, you know, ultimately. And I think that's the part of the Ruby community that was so different in the earlier days, you know, was like kind of before we were all air quotes serious developers at serious companies, where, you know, maintainable, scalable, you know, upgradable, secure, all these other words become the most important ones. And I think, to be honest, that's perfectly reasonable when you're a company of GitHub size. You know, we've got a lot of developers now and calling it webhook service is just more straightforward and easier to get onboarding. But when you look to a startup or a group of friends working on a side project, I see no reason why you wouldn't call it your cool idea. Like bite-sized is one of the ones I'm working on my size. Like, you know, it makes more sense to do that because when I work on it, I want to like have a little smile and I want it to be fun.
Bring a little bit of delight and joy into it. That's interesting with the naming topic there. It's funny. You mentioned Rick Olson, and some of the original stuff that's in my Oh My Z-Shell was inspired by Rick. And like Oh My Z-Shell wasn't like any clever. I didn't think of it as a clever name. I just repurposed a different project name that I had used called Oh My Science. And I just like, wow, this other thing, Oh My Z-Shell, I don't know what I'm doing. But people think it as like some clever thing. And I'm like, actually just kind of just threw out one day. And if you hadn't actually mentioned Zelda, I wouldn't have got the reference because I didn't play Zelda. So, but no, it is fascinating thinking about how as a company matures. So I'm always thinking about like, at what point do you feel like a company as they're growing or early on in their kind of infancy, should they be thinking about those types of like, how well is someone in 5 years going to understand what I'm naming this versus I don't even know if we're going to be in a business in 5 years.
It's so funny. Like, I really think we all overestimate the scale and the speed at which we will need to grow, even at GitHub, you know, and GitHub has been a crazy, you know, growth journey over the 15 plus years, right? And so when you're starting a project or you're working on a project, I think it's really an encapsulation of your team, you, your culture, you know, everything that's going on at that moment and worrying about, you know, well, should we call it webhook service or not? I think it's more a reflection of, well, what do you kind of value in this project? Like, is this something that's fun and joyful and quirky and like how Slack went from Glitch, you know, in their whole like online game situation, you know, that was a whole different vibe that has impacted how they build software. Or you can go, I want this to be the most sort of accessible, easy to access, easy to understand project. And if that's core to your culture, then a cute name is not going to be an important part of it. I would say, like, you know, the vast majority of folks that are scaling projects or startups that I talk to, the one thing that they choose early is not like the maintainability of software, it's the complexity of their tech stack. It's like, are we using Kubernetes and Dynamo and PlanetSide and Postgres, and or are we launching this into a VM or just containers and a database? And the companies and the projects and the startups that seem to have the most issue scaling is, yeah, sure, there's probably quirky names and the one person that knows how to write that class, she doesn't work here anymore or whatever. But ultimately, it's the overcomplexity of the entire system is what's caused the issue. And so usually when I'm talking to startups or, you know, working on a side project, I'm kind of hoping back to the glory days of Heroku of just like, no, it's just these two things. And then like errors go here. And then as I add new stuff, the first question is, well, can I just jam this in MySQL or can I jam this in Postgres, not even add Redis if I don't have to? Simply because I think simple software is better over time because it's much harder to remove complexity over time, much easier to add it. So I'd rather constrict on adding complexity for as long as I can.
That's a good takeaway there. I was one of the things I do consulting work with, or my company does, and we'll talk with companies and like people that we're talking that are on the team now sometimes they don't even understand why they like the previous people chose to use other system X, whatever. And they're like, oh, there must have been a good reason for it. And we don't always get to ask those previous people, right? They're not around to ask. And sometimes I actually am suspicious. Like, I think people just wanted to experiment with that thing because they thought, well, maybe this would be useful. I heard other people talking about it and this might be a good decision for us to do it. So it's like, how do you think about, you know, when you're in a company of your scale now, where how does the team kind of think about experimenting with new things while being like, let's just do the thing that we're already doing. Can we just tack it onto your existing database versus bringing up some other type of infrastructure system or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the thing that we're doing at GitHub generally, or like have done over the years at GitHub, is kind of this, you know, staircase of MVPs, you know, where it's like, okay, there's kind of just like a simple tech demo that's like cobbled together. And then it's something closer to an MVP that we try out on a new thing. And then we get to real MVP that you can touch and feel. And then maybe at that point is when we kind of make the decision of like, okay, are we going to tip into this may not launch as a feature or as a product, but we're going to commit to some degree of the tech stack. I think it's less about trying new technologies for the sake of trying them while you're building. I think you need to be convicted that that new technology is going to provide you something that the old technology will not in order to make that change. So like, you know, GitHub had been historically a pretty strongly, you know, we're simple HTML or simple JavaScript shop for quite some time. And I think, you know, when we started to embark on something like GitHub Projects, which is our first real foray into the single page architecture model, it's, you know, not saying it can't be done in other ways, you know, but I would say that as we were trying different techniques when we were building this MVP, it kind of became clear that, oh, geez, like there are benefits from our side to do some more of this in a single page way, and we'll still render it, you know, a lot of the HTML server side. We're not sort of dogmatic about staying in, say, like the Rails ecosystem and just doing it the Rails way, as it were, but we're also not rushing out to try new tech. I think where we've run into trouble is where we find a new tech, it solves a very particular purpose, and then we're like, okay, now we just have to bring this everywhere and it'll fix everything. And in the end, it just adds way more complexity because a lot of tech doesn't need to be everywhere, you know? And so, you know, when you're starting out and working on a startup, I think, you know, it's kind of cliche at this point to say, hey, when you're working, like focus on solving the problem and not just introducing all this new technology. But I strongly believe that to be true. It is adding a tax and increasing the incline of what you need to do every time you try and go, hey, I don't know, we're just using, you know, Rails and maybe I want to use React. Like, why don't I build my app in React in order to do this? Awesome for a side project, awesome for a weekend. Probably not the best idea when you're trying to build a business out of the gate. And you can't sort of be wrong and just throw the whole thing out.
Hey folks, it's me, Robbie. I want you to take a moment and close your eyes. Now picture your code and your applications as a symphony. Now to keep that symphony playing smoothly, you need an orchestra of tools. That's where our podcast sponsor, AppSignal, takes center stage. They combine the elegance of error tracking, the precision of performance monitoring, and the harmony of logging into one symphonic suite. Whether you're composing with Ruby, jamming with Elixir, orchestrating with Node.js, or harmonizing with Python, or maybe even a little bit of flourish of JavaScript, AppSignal's got the sheet music for you. And here's the crescendo. Plans start at just $23 US a month. That's gotta be music to your budget's ears. Plus they're certified ISO 27001 and they dance the GDPR and HIPAA compliance beats. So don't miss a beat, my friends. Head on over to appsignal.com and tell them that your good friend Robbie from Maintainable sent you. Now, open your eyes and let the symphony of smooth coding begin. Let's get back to our show. That reminds me of, you know, there's companies that will come to us and they'll have a couple of developers on their team and they'll have a couple of microservices and they've not really been able to, let's say, make them very independent. Like they actually got to the point where they have to deploy all of them in parallel to do any, like every new feature is like, we need to add some new database columns and some backend stuff so people can manage stuff on the backend. And we got this React app. We need to make some changes, you know, and interact with Ruby on Rails on the back end, and we have to deploy them in parallel. And those are actually two different deployment pipelines. So we just have to push these things out. And I'm like, who thought this was a good idea? And they're like, well, that seemed to be where everybody else was going. But I'm like, you only have two or three people on your team to manage all this. What's your kind of take on that? Like, you're at a much bigger scale. Do you have like the same sort of concerns? Like, how do we navigate this long term? Or is that more of an issue for like small teams to think about?
I think it's an issue for all of us to think about ultimately. You know, I mean, I think GitHub is still vastly a Ruby on Rails monolith. You know, we have Go services in particular in a variety of places. Some of our acquisitions that have joined GitHub remain in different tech stacks like JavaScript, etc. A little bit of Rust here and there. But like, while we were on the precipice of the microservice journey, we kind of learned a couple of hard lessons, which is what you just described, like different trade-offs. Nothing is free. There's no one tech that's just going to save it all. Serverless didn't do that. Kubernetes isn't doing that. Microservices isn't doing that. And the wheel turns and we're back to this idea of, you know, at Rails world, this app can just do it. You got a disk now and a database and good luck, y'all. And I'll just say like my personal opinion is much closer to that than it is the microservice culture, because when you have this tiny team, you're going, okay, well, in order for us to well encapsulate this data and well encapsulate the function, and we want it to be clear, we're going to make incredibly, you know, concise services and then deploy 55 of them in our team of three. Mm-hmm. And my question is, like, is that actually more concise or not? Like, is it actually more, will it actually have more uptime or not? And so, you know, there, like I said at the very beginning, Hookshot was a service from the early days. There are definitely workloads that clearly are service or services or microservices or something. Background jobs being a version of that whole idea, obviously. But at the same time, I think we're mainly past the, you know, new projects starting up and there's like eight microservices just to, like, you know, launch a CRUD function. It feels like we're no longer hearing that siren song in the community as much as we were. But I think, again, like, all old ideas become new again at some point, and we'll have to see where we ultimately land up. Again, if with AI helping write code, et cetera, it's easier to make mistakes faster, you know? And so I think that sends us down a path of like, well, suddenly you don't have to go, well, it's going to take me so much longer to write eight services. Well, now it's going to take you 50% of the time to write the eight services. Does that mean you should write eight services or not? We'll have to see how that kind of plays out culturally for us.
You know, I'm curious, what's your current take on the metaphor technical debt? Is that something that you use in your conversations internally, or do you describe it as something else? I'll leave it as an open question.
We definitely talk about technical debt. I think the issue is that the term implies that you're paying it off, and debt will accrue additional interest every day, month, year, hour, second, however you want to measure it. I think the reality is that some code simply aren't assets, you know, but that doesn't necessarily make them debt. It's sort of like we've depreciated, a slip of the tongue. It's like we depreciated, you know, that code and it's still there and it's operating, but we're not going to get any net new value out of it until we do something new. And so I think it's too easy to say, hey, this code that I wrote 5 years ago is debt because it's not as clean, it's not as clear, it's not using the new library, et cetera. I don't think code becomes debt simply through age or through lack of using modern, you know, software practices. It becomes debt because it is slowing you down. It is stopping you from solving the problem that you're trying to solve with software. Like, software is helping us do something for someone. It can be a craft, but like a well-made chair, it only matters once you sit down in it. And so it's not technical debt that it wobbles necessarily. If I can sit in the chair and I'm comfortable, it might be just doing its job. And so we're not so dogmatic about the idea that, you know, the code that Technoweenie or Defunct or Scott Chacon or PJ or me wrote all those years ago is still there. In a lot of ways, it's, if it's doing its job, who cares? And as long as it's patched, double who cares? Because ultimately users are getting their webhooks delivered every day.
Do your engineering teams, I don't know a lot about how the structure of all your development engineering teams work there, but do you ever like try to allocate a certain amount of time or budget or something in terms of like working on, say, I'm air quoting, maintenance type tasks, whatever that might be, refactoring, upgrades, things like that, versus feature development? Do you think about it that way, or is it more, do you even have an understanding of how that works anymore?
Yeah. I mean, it's less about the 20% time, you know, or pick a percentage, and much more about sort of like thinking about it like envelope budgeting, you know, like there's so much money you have to put in to keep the lights on, just the running a service that's a dial tone service for the world. There's a lot of work that just goes into that. And then there's this degree of, okay, we're going to do new feature development. And I think even in new feature development, it's really kind of two envelopes. It's some of it's exploration, and other of it is executing a plan. Like, we know we're going to do this, and now we need to build it out. And then finally, on that other side, like whether we call it technical debt or not, the real thing is, how are we kind of enabling GitHub to remain reliable and be up and secure? That's part of that. You might consider some of that to be KTLO, keep the lights on, but some of it might be in that tech debt side. And then there's all kinds of projects that are preparing us for that future exploration or that future development. And so I think for GitHub, a lot of the attention is on kind of like preparing for that future, letting us continue to explore. You talked about the early days of GitHub. A lot of that was the exploration. It wasn't like, I have a plan and I'm going to go do this. It's a lot of like, I wonder if this will work. But when you're at our scale and at our age, like, you need to prepare for that sort of activity by being upgraded, running, you know, Rails main, staying up to date on Ruby. That's a lot of work just to stay up to date. And so it's a dichotomy, and per team, it's very different, you know, depending on what area of the app that you're working in. We've tried historically this idea of like, we'll save a certain percentage of time for tech debt, but like, it never ends up being something that a simple rule at the scale of 1,000+ developers or engineers is going to solve it in our culture. We want to provide that like autonomy, the ability to ship to learn, get something out there, test a hypothesis, which kind of lets us be a lot more flexible in those sorts of, investments and work.
You're mentioning that at a scale of like over 1,000 engineers, it might be difficult to just throw a percentage out there. And then on really small teams, it's hard for them to do it because they're like, well, we don't feel like we're a big enough team to even be able to make sense of the numbers. We're kind of, can we really, like, if your numbers are too small, it could fluctuate week to week, right? Do you use any other sort of metrics like developer satisfaction type things internally, or just to get a sense of like where friction's happening? Like, oh, we might need to use this to help maybe improve some, smooth out some part of the process for the engineering teams?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a big question that I think every customer asks us is like, well, how do you measure your developer teams? And I'll tell you, we primarily measure it through developer satisfaction. So we run surveys that have verbatims, and Microsoft does something very similar in their teams as well, where the numbers really help, but the real stories in the verbatims, what people are writing into the comments. And so that helps us understand where, our merge queue, like our deployment train systems, like might be the actual friction point in the system, or code review might be an issue. Or time zones, which are not easy things to fix per se. You have to figure out processes to make that better. That ends up being where we put a lot of the attention to ensure that like our systems are good. And I'm kind of speaking on behalf of our engineering teams and engineering leaders. I'll say too, in my current role, which I've kind of evolved out of engineering and into the business side, but as a COO, I think the other thing too is a lot of things that make developers productive or not are also sort of like that company level survey and folks writing in and sharing about what's working and what's not. Folks wanting to get together with their teams. GitHub has been a remote company essentially since its inception, I guess. In its inception, it was very much San Francisco based, but then very quickly, became a remote company. And that's remained true to today. And so, like, hearing that, well, I want to get together with my team and digging into that more deeply, you kind of realize, like, at the end of the day, we're all human. And when I'm reviewing your PR, Robbie, like, it helps to know that we've chatted about other things and we've chatted about the podcast and we've talked and we've built a connection, and that's hard to do, online over and over or only and only. And so, whether we go down to the engineering systems and practices or just sort of like, what does your company value? Either way, I think you just kind of ask and you listen versus getting too caught up in, well, I want to make sure that our deploy times are below this number, or I only care about PRs, or I only care about lines or review time or latency or mean time to deploy. You name all the stats that big companies are measuring. It's good to measure those things. Information is what drives change, but the things you measure will be focused on by everyone working in the underlying system. And so, like, you do need to be careful about sort of the things you put the most power behind, which is why we're basically putting the power behind the devs. We want to hear what's working and what's not directly from them.
Do you find that as you're talking to peers at other large kind of companies that they're approaching that in a similar way? Or do you feel like because you're an engineering organization building products primarily for engineers, that gives you kind of a unique take on that? How do you kind of measure, like, align that, I suppose?
There are a bunch of other companies that focus on the DevSat idea, similar to us. But I think there's other, I would say engineer-led, engineer-focused companies like Stripe that are like heavily engineering metric-based, and measure just about everything and the performance of it all. I think the issue isn't so much, like I was saying, what you measure. It's as much as how much value and attention are you giving those things that you measure. If you care most about, I was talking to Cloud Zero, like they care most about how quickly a developer can join in and ultimately deploy. Like, that's the most important metric. And that's the one they loop on. Well, there's a million other things you could measure as part of that, but ultimately that's the one thing you care about, right? And so you're gonna, okay, well, we can't let the test get too slow. We can't, we got to make it easy for folks to onboard, all these sorts of other activities. I think the thing that I can say to be true is that there is no answer to the metrics question. Like, everyone has a different answer. And I think that's because at the end of the day, that developer measurement is just as much a measurement of your culture as it is of anything else. And so, like, I would love to be able to come to the world and say, hey, it's done. We figured it out. Here's the number, and like Abhi Nova, who used to be at GitHub, is working on this right now as his full job. Like, very lots of great articles and research that go into this. And a lot of the recent publishing that he's done has kind of come to the same conclusion, which is like, focus on DevSat. Like, DevSat will give you a good ratio of signal to noise. And space metrics and Dora metrics and others, they may not be the way to drive that change. Because again, if I measure something and focus on it, it's going to drive culture, or my culture can drive what we're building. And then how do we just have some signal to know if we're, you know, moving in the right direction?
I appreciate you digging into that for us. And I'll definitely include some links to the, what was that person's name again you just mentioned?
Abhi Noba.
Do you find yourself more often on team refactor or team rewrite?
Oh man, almost always on refactor. I mean, my thought is that when you write a piece of software, I think we've all experienced at some point in our careers a comment that says, for the love of God, don't edit this. Like, you know, like the world ends if you touch this. And I think that's kind of silly, you know, like, and kind of cliche, but at the same time, it shows that the system is capturing something inherently just by running. You know, it's, that is actually what happens when I put something in the top and something comes out the bottom, not what I believe is happening inside of the program. And so I think when you do a rewrite, it's not about, I want to leave this poor technology behind and I want to get to the modern future. It's that I would like to change how the problem is being solved. And I'm going to do that with a net new technology. Because if you don't start from that thought process, you end up going into it and accidentally mutating the system that you're rewriting without you knowing it. Write all the tests you want, write all the acceptance tests you want. Like, you will find something, or at least, you know, or you're better dev than me and anyone I've met, that, you know, something will change. But I think almost always it's a refactor. I will say, like, little asterisk, that I think there's times in which technology has evolved so much that it is no longer feasible, you know, to keep investing in that old technology and refactoring it. Maybe you built your app on top of Electron and you're like, I have to rewrite it into Swift, not because Swift is so much cooler, but it unlocks something for me that I can't do with Electron, that, and it wasn't available when I made that choice. I think that is a feasible reason to do a rewrite. But like, going, well, I have a Ruby app and Go will be more memory efficient, so I'm going to rewrite it in Go, that is not about changing what the solution can look like. It's changing some other operating principle. And I generally think it's better that you'll just refactor that instead.
No, I tend to agree with that. And I think that a lot of organizations that, they'll come to us and be like, hey, they'll ask our opinion, like, should we rewrite this? Because, like, and sometimes it's a concern about, like, we've had bad luck with the last few people we've hired. They can't wrap their head around it. And so we talked to someone and they said, yeah, Ruby on Rails is old and you should use this new thing. And if you rewrite it, and then I'm like, well, I don't know if that's the answer necessarily, but I mean, and then, or I've actually talked to some companies. I'm actually talking to one recently who they're using Ruby on Rails. Apologies to the audience. I'm not trying to have so many guests that are Ruby on Rails area, but that's my network. But the people come in and they're like, hey, we want to rewrite it in a brand new Rails application. And I was like, so my advice to them was, well, if you're going to seriously go down the rewrite path, I would challenge you to, like, compare other technology stacks. Like, is that the right tool anymore for what your company needs? And if you're not willing to have that conversation, I'm like, I don't know, why are you having a rewrite conversation? Like, let's have an honest conversation about it. Like, maybe a different platform. Maybe you're struggling to keep developers there and you have a recruitment challenge. Like, is that going to go away? Maybe you can find people with a different programming language that are more affordable. What have you? Do that. And if you don't want to go down that path, I don't recommend a rewrite in the same technology. Does that seem like good advice from you?
That totally resonates with me. I think the thing that I come back to as you're talking about that example is, I think I definitely always want to zoom out to, like, what's the biggest problem that you're trying to encapsulate here? And so, like, in your example, I think it's totally normal to be like, well, my app is written in COBOL, which, like, I'm sure no customer that comes to you says that, but there are tons of financial institutions that do come to you and say that, or come to us, you know, and say that. They go, well, I got COBOL, and I mean, there's only so many devs that know that natively anymore. And so now what do I do? And, you know, I'm not going to be like, well, let's teach every dev COBOL and refactor it, because you might change the system. It is okay to say, okay, my tech stack is no longer viable at what I can afford to pay for it, you know. Or if you have 18 microservices, it's like, okay, well, if I don't want to run 18 microservices anymore, you're darn close to a rewrite regardless. But I think generally when I'm talking to engineers or devs about rewrites, etc., or technology change, it tends to be, I think I can change, like, I think I can solve the problem if I do this. And I'm like, okay, hold on. Let's understand. You're a company that makes widgets and you want to get the widgets out faster. Moving from JavaScript to Rails or Rails to Go or Go to Rust, is that really going to make the widgets come out faster? Or do you need to pay for faster CI? And at the end of the day, those types of questions, I think, are where we end up going, well, if I just add in Postgres, then I can put JSON in natively and I don't need to worry about it. It's like, sure, you know, but what's the cost of making that change, making that rewrite and fixing everything to now use Postgres? And that's where I just challenge folks to really sit down and go, what problem are you actually solving? Not what problem are you saying you're solving? Because like the inevitable solution is this other technology. To your point, if you come in and say, I can't hire devs, I'm looking for help, I want to go to Rails, you going, well, hold on a minute. If the problem is you want to find a tech stack that you can easily hire developers for, let me show you this chart that says the number, you know what I mean? The number of developers per language and the price that they cost. That's the problem you are solving. And I always want to back up. I get very suspicious whenever a solution is the inherent answer to a problem. I talk to my teams about this all the time. I'm like, hold on, if you present a problem to me and the solution's like baked into that, the inevitable conclusion, I am not convinced that you understand the problem well enough, because there are very few problems that are like, well, now I do this. I'm thirsty. Okay, I can drink water. We serve a million to 100 million developers every day and we want to scale. And now we will move to C. Timeout. Some backup and help me understand like where we're going with this line of questioning.
We'll be back with our interview with Kyle in just a moment. Hi, it's me, Robbie. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you for listening to the podcast. You know the deal. You know the drill. Head over to the podcast website, sign up for the newsletter, maybe write a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, give us a rating, say, hey, that episode with Kyle is one of my favorite episodes, or I learned so much, or Robbie sounds like a really weird person. 2 stars. Whatever, just be honest, I don't mind. But the more people talk about Maintainable, the more people that might get exposed to it. So help me out here, please. Also, is there someone you think I should interview on the podcast? Shoot me an email to Robbie with a Y at maintainable.fm. And now, let's get back to our interview with Kyle Daigle. So one of the things I would be amiss not to dive into the squishy topic of AI in GitHub Copilot. So I don't tend to talk about a lot on this podcast about what's new in technology, but you know, I've used it a few times to bounce some questions off of it, and it helped unlock some ideas for me, and I found it very useful the handful of times I've done it. But I'm curious about, like, how do you see Copilot helping teams? You know, I think about it, like, as I'm currently looking at it, is like it feels very one-on-one. It's like me pairing with like the AI overlords, giving me some advice, or at least pointing, helping explain what I'm looking at, or maybe giving some suggestions on things. What about like on an engineering team level? Like, how do you see AI helping teams better help improve, like, say, legacy code in particular, but also like it feels very like one-on-one the way the prompting works. How do you see that kind of panning out for like the teams as a whole and sharing that?
I think with Copilot, because it is such a clear like use case in the dev loop, you know, I'm typing code and it finishes not just a line usually, but multiple lines. Like, that's a very clear loop. You're basically finishing hypothetically what my brain is attempting to put onto paper. It's easy to kind of get caught up in like, well, if I'm doing this, like, how will I collaborate then? Because like, you know, I'm coding and maybe like I want to work with the team better, et cetera. And I think when we talked to devs about this, we've run like a couple of surveys and research projects. We were told early on that I think it was 88% of devs feel like the AI tools are making them more collaborative. And I was like, that's not what I would have expected. So we dug in a lot more to better understand. And there's a couple of things that kind of came out of that. The first is that because many of our customers find that when they have their teams use Copilot to write code, the answers, the like code that comes out that gets reviewed is faster to be reviewed, in part because the reviews take less of the not linting bugs that can be catched, but the intermediate bugs, you know, that like linting's not great at catching, but like because it's Copilot is emulating your coding style, it's able to like not have Robbie the senior eng go in and say, well, hold on a minute, that's not how we do this here. It catches more of that. And so you end up collaborating way more in the pull request, but more importantly, before you even start coding on the bigger questions. the architecture, the approach. Why are we going to use this tech versus that tech? Because that is where you really need to invest more of that collaboration time. It's on more times and discussions like that. So with customers, we see in at GitHub too, it's a bit more time in like writing that issue and discussing what you're going to do and et cetera. And it's not like, I'm going to write a class that does this. It is, well, I want to send 15 webhooks instead of one webhook with every request. What is that going to break in the system? Well, let's dive in. And then implementing that in Copilot tends to be a lot faster. The other place that I think collaboration or like that feeling of team effort, you kind of mentioned it, is like for both junior and senior devs, when you go into a code base you already know like really well, particularly for the senior folks, like Copilot can feel like, sure, like I'm typing, it's finishing, that's cool. Like I knew that, you know, let me just keep moving. But what we've heard, and I've done this myself, is like when I go into a code base that I wrote like 11 years ago, and I'm like, oh, what Ruby version is this? You know? And I'm like, all right, well, what can you tell me what this method even means in modern Ruby? Asking questions like that tends to be this interesting sort of L&D learning development moment for folks, because it enables them to talk to someone that's not judging them, that's available 24/7. And then the senior dev or the other person or that friend that you might bug no longer needs to answer those questions for you. You instead talk about the higher level thing that you're trying to do. So frequently my friend Justin Searles and I, well, I message each other about these sorts of things, and he'll always be like, ah, well, you know, I'm working on this and I found this bug and now what? And I joked with him the last time. I was like, just go ask. Like, you don't need to ask me. Like, the thing's going to tell you. And sure enough, like, AI is going and gives him the answer. And he joked about, like, oh, now we can talk about the merits of it. I think we were talking about the word inner source, which he was not familiar with, and which is a very GitHub concern. And we talk to customers about all the time, basically how your devs should have access to basically to all the code inside your company, similar to open source. That way you can accept contributions across. Very normal for, I think, more modern companies, very abnormal for large, enormous companies. And so while Copilot was able to answer what that word means, then he and I could discuss the merits of that and why that's a good thing to do. And that's very similar to, I think, how we see other devs collaborate when they no longer have to talk about the nitty gritty of, you know, how to do something.
I'm curious about, you know, you mentioned like how senior developers and, you know, people further along in the career, they can focus a little bit more on those higher level discussions and planning things out. And then on the, you know, say junior developers in particular, and then, you know, I could see how they're able to interact with something like Copilot to help them navigate and understand some stuff and maybe give them some suggestions, whether they fully understand what feedback and things that are suggesting or not is a whole other question. That's a big, its own podcast topic itself. But I'm curious, how is your team thinking about how junior developers are going to be able to pick up those skills along the way to have those bigger, higher level conversations if they're kind of maybe more working more, like it was just being exposed to what's, if they're not having those collaborative moments with the senior developers or, you know, when they're collaborating together, or how do you make time for that and think about that with like with the tools and like not just being like, here, Copilot. And then, and at some point you just mysteriously become a senior developer and can have these higher level conversations.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I think that there's no world right now wherein you hand a junior dev or an aspiring dev Copilot or honestly any AI tool and be like, just do 6 months of this and we'll see you on the other side. That just doesn't work. You know, I think that similar to other sort of education questions, you know, like how do you learn by doing, and how is AI going to change education? I think the thing that it will enable is that it knows what you know. It knows the errors you're making, and it can help unblock you faster, but it has not replaced the video series, the teaching, the working with a senior dev, the being an intern and working as part of an engineering team, the osmosis. You know, I think the thing I'm most kind of interested in is what boot camps are going to do or are doing already, in part because, you know, I think there's plenty of boot camps that do an excellent job of getting you kind of prepared and going and real and gritty. And I think the thing that I'm curious about is like, how can AI just be a part of that? Because it's not going away. Like, it's a part of it already, but it's important that you understand the underlying concepts, because if we believe that AI will make you more collaborative and have you focus on the higher order problems that you need to solve, you can't have this enormous leaky abstraction of like, well, I don't understand what any of the code does, how it works, etc., but I'm really good at problem solving in the current era of software dev. Like, over time, we can all hope and dream that like, we're just going to be clicking blocks together and magically software comes out the other side. But like, we're nowhere near that as a repeatable process. And so for junior devs, I have a friend that's looking to jump into software development. You know, he's in his mid 40s, looking to do a major career change. And so I spent a lot of time talking to friends like, well, what do I do? I gave him Copilot. It made it accessible and interesting to him. It kind of lit the flame of, oh, I could see this being possible for me versus this is totally unavailable. But the next step that he's taking is going to a boot camp. Like he'd like to do a boot camp, a remote one, so he can continue on with his life. And I'm hoping that, you know, if he wants to, that he'll join, you know, the software development ethos here and join us in coding. But no one's quite figured it out. I think this is rife for investment and focus. You know, I think GitHub can do part of that. But the reality is similar to the earlier eras of Rails, where everyone had some sort of REPL app that you could use to learn how to learn Rails back in the 2-ish era, maybe 3, I forget. We need that back, like for coding, with an assistant that's not just telling you, nope, that's not the method. This is the method. It's like, I can see how you'd think that's the method. Let me explain what that method does. GSub is a little bit different than split or whatever. And that is where I think we'll actually see this huge uptick for those junior devs or devs that are still kind of learning on the job.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't used Copilot enough to know the answer to this. Maybe you could probably might be one of the best people to ask this is when I interact with like tools like ChatGPT, it starts to seemingly remember things about me, you know, in a way. And does Copilot kind of have outside of like the, I just think of Copilot as being a lot more of an objective thing versus like, hey, this seems to be Robbie's personality about how he likes to interact and ask his dumb questions. And he seems to enjoy sarcasm. Is that part of like what you folks are thinking about with that, or is that something you can't really disclose?
As it stands right now, it's looking at the repo, it's looking at other context around you, it's looking at your open files, it's looking at questions you've asked previously, and it's passing that all into this mega prompt that's, you know, been analyzed, etc., etc. I think the thing that, you know, we're looking at in other folks is similar to what you were saying, which is you already know so much about how I'm interacting with the code, what I'm accepting, what I'm not accepting, issues I've written, pull requests I've written, comments I've written, etc. It's easier to bring a lot more of that in to Copilot or other AI tools, you know, to help fill in that gap. I think the thing with coding that I find so interesting is that everyone believes they're incredibly novel, like when they code, like, well, my code is very different and it will never work. And sure enough, we're all just like repeatable robots when it comes to coding to some degree. And it's able to, you know, quickly realize, similar to what you said, oh, well, Kyle never uses map. He always uses select or like whatever. And so it'll give you something like that. I will say, the thing that I'm most interested in AI, like regardless of, you know, Copilot or GitHub or whatever, is I'm extremely compelled to bring like the idea of ambient AI into the world a bit more. The idea that, you know, this conversation, what I've read from Robbie, the fact that we've known each other through the internet for so many years, when I hop on a Zoom call, like, why doesn't it just kind of like come up and be like, the last time you saw Robbie was in Amsterdam, you know, because like I'm a dad who's tired most of the time and I wouldn't mind that additional help. Or when I ask, do I need to wear a jacket outside today, it doesn't, like, there shouldn't be an algorithm that says, well, if it's above 65, yes, if it's below 65, no. If you were in San Francisco, I live in Connecticut, and so it's like, if it's above 30, yeah, no. If it's below 30, maybe yes, you know. But like, AI can help us do so much more if we can figure out the right kind of interaction models, which get me back to like, if you're solving the right problem, there's a lot that we can do there. And so I think the programming and Copilot side of what it knows about you is really just the start of what hopefully will be a much more helpful tools for all of us to do our day-to-day work.
You know, this all circles back to us trying to also produce more maintainable software. And I know we all want to show off how individually unique we are with our approaches, and we can use like pull requests and our commenting on issues and share some of our personality. That's, but there's another aspect of that. You can, you know, the things like Copilot can like look at that, what I'm actually sharing, but it's not necessarily what I'm thinking or what I'm feeling, you know? So that's like another element of like, I think would be interesting if like, I'm just thinking, I'm sure this is probably, it would be amazing if like when I'm interacting on a PR with someone and I'm giving feedback, I'm always like, we talk about like, how do you submit a PR for review and like on a project in a company? How do you review? How do you be mindful about being a good peer reviewer? But also how do you accept the feedback and not just take it defensively or whatever, you know? And like, everybody's going to internalize it differently. And like, so there's all these like back and forth things things that are happening and like there's the stuff that we're not saying and we're not saying out loud because we're like, I don't want to be a jerk, you know, whatever. People think I'm gonna be a jerk if I say this, but some people are like, could you please just tell me what you actually think and not hold it back? And so there's still a lot of stuff for humans to process. And so I don't think they're gonna take away all that anytime soon.
Oh, no. And I mean, I think, you know, I think with what we've seen with AI is that in a lot of the use cases that you just described, it's like, oh, we'll summarize it for you. Or you'll write write 5 words and I'll write a perfect message. And I think we've been running some experiments with our GitHub Next team, like the team that thinks out a couple clicks, you know? And a lot of it is, well, Robbie, like this feedback is a little bit more direct than your usual feedback. Like, is that intended? Or looking at feedback that was given, adding feedback from a bot and presenting it from the bot instead of from Robbie, in part because we just know humans like don't care if Hubot is like, hey, you did these 4 things wrong. But when Robbie says I did these 4 things wrong, I'm like, oh God, am I still here? You know,
yeah.
Where like the robot, everyone's like a fine, stupid bot, like, you know, whatever, I'll do this. And so I think there's a way where AI can really help us solve those problems, still have very human interactions and discussions, but instead of like, we're so simple, let me just summarize it and unsummarize it. And then we're all just discussing via summarizations. Instead, it can help us to communicate a little bit better, but then also, you know, take some of the emotion out of it when we don't need to be emotional. It's just facts we're sharing with each other. But because of, you know, our ethnographic, sociographic situation, like it's not that simple as to say, well, Kyle gave this feedback on a pull request. If I do that right now, everyone will jump because they're, uh-oh, why is Kyle saying this? Where my feedback could be wrong. And likely if it's on code, it probably is these days.
No, it's very true. You have to consider the weight of what we're conveying when we're doing things. And sometimes I'm like, just please ignore my title. Just, this is just my thought. Please disagree if you have a better thought on this. I get that. A couple of quick last questions for you, Kyle. Is there a non-technical, non-software book that you find yourself recommending to peers most often?
It's this book called Turn the Ship Around. I forget the author, but he was a submarine captain that took on the lowest performing submarine in the U.S. Navy and brought it to the top of the list. And it describes this idea of, it's funny that we landed on this, it describes this idea of like a leader-leader culture, where you're not saying yes to allow people who work for you or report to you to do their job. Like, it's an assumption that you're a leader too. You're going to do your job and I'm going to sort of just be here to support that and agree. And if you want to ask questions, you can. And so the book has a sort of unfortunate title that implies if you read it, something is very bad at where you work or your problems you're solving. But I think it's one of the more influential leadership books that I've read. And if you're one of those people that are like, oh my God, I hate leadership books, I hate business books, it has a lot of interesting historic stories in it too, that I found much more interesting to apply to my day-to-day life.
Nice. I'll definitely include that in the links for everybody in the show notes. Thank you so much, Kyle, for stopping by to Talk Shop. It's been a delight catching up with you and looking forward to rubbing shoulders with you again at some upcoming conference, I hope, in the coming year or so.
Definitely. Thanks so much for having me. It's great. Oh.